We're going to map 125 years of Afrofuturist thinking about megacities as potentially utopian spaces for creating new and more equitable modes of high-density living based on the coincidence rather than the separation of nature and technology.
Redesigning Cities, Speedwell Foundation Talks
at Georgia Tech.
Welcome to episode 21 of Redesigning Cities, the Speedwell Foundation Talks at Georgia Tech. I am your host, Ellen Dunham Jones, a professor in the School of Architecture, where I direct the MS in Urban Design. Today is the kickoff to season 4, or perhaps more appropriately, the liftoff. It is my pleasure to welcome Dr. Lisa Yazyk and Shanitra Wisdom to join me in a discussion of redesigning cities in science fiction, with a particular focus on megacities and Afrofuturism. I think it's a particularly compelling topic for architects, urban designers, and planners, because we're inherently futurists. We work under present conditions, but produce designs and plans that anticipate and imagine changes in the built environment, as well as in society, technology, climate, etc. When we present our work, we tell stories. But part of why I'm excited to have today's conversation is to ask the question, who really writes the future? We designers like to think that we do, but are we imaginative enough? Are we thinking critically enough about who we're designing for and whose voices are included in we? In the early and mid-20th century, it was fairly common to see visionary plans for future cities 50 or 100 years out. Today, the future in design projects rarely seems more than 5 years out. I think Lisa and Nitra might convince us that designers' and urbanists' imaginations, critical capacities, and storytelling ability might be emboldened by reading more science fiction and Afrofuturist literature. I want to introduce Shanitra Wisdom. Like many of the students and faculty in the audience, I've had the pleasure of working with Nitra for 8 years in her role as academic advisor here in the School of Architecture at Georgia Tech. What many of you might not know, however, is that Nitra is an Afrofuturist enthusiast and writer in publications that center the experiences of queer, Black, and other marginalized communities. She is a 2021 Para Plus Fellow, and I hope you look forward to reading more of her work as much as I do. Nitra will join the latter part of the conversation and then moderate Q&A. Lisa Yazyk is Regents Professor. That's a big deal. In Georgia Tech's School of Literature, Media, and Communication, where she explores science fiction as a global language. She is particularly interested in issues of gender, race, and science and technology in science fiction across media. She's written several books, including Galactic Suburbia, Recovering Women's Voices in Science Fiction, and most recently, co-edited Literary Afrofuturism in the 21st Century. I'm delighted to invite Lisa and present some of her work.
Thank you so much. And I want to thank Ellen for this wonderful opportunity for arranging this event and, of course, the fantastic introduction. I want to thank Nitra for joining us here to share her perspectives on Afrofuturism. I'm personally most excited about that. And, of course, I want to thank all of you for being here with us today. So, as Ellen suggested, I'm going to be talking with you today about megacities and social justice in science fiction. And so let's go ahead to the first slide. Cities have been central to science fiction really as long as the genre has been around. And it makes sense, right? Because cities are sites of techno-scientific innovation and cultural exchange. And in fact, I want to focus today on the concept of the megacity, which is an urban space with over 10 million inhabitants, which emerges in the 20th century in tandem with genre science fiction and grows up alongside the genre, is still very much with it today. Now, thinking about megacities is really important, especially I think in Afrofuturism, which is a multi-genre aesthetic movement that uses the tropes of science fiction to make us rethink our assumptions about the relations of science, technology, and race, to remember the historic contributions of people of color to technoscientific modernity, and to imagine a range of futures in full color. So now that we've gotten those definitions out of the way, we're going to go forward with our project, which is this. In the next 15 minutes, we're going to map 125 years of Afrofuturist thinking about megacities as potentially utopian spaces for creating new and more equitable modes of high density living based on the coincidence rather than the separation of nature and technology. Now, for some of you, this might seem like an odd claim to think about the megacity as a utopia. And that's because while the original definition of the megacity was fairly neutral, by the late 1920s, urban planners were talking about the megacity as a megapolis and in almost entirely negative terms, as an entity that would eventually crumble under its own weight. Now, science fiction authors anticipated that idea at least 30, 40 or 40 years earlier, and they were certainly quick to incorporate representations of the megapolis as dystopia into their own fiction. And we see this everywhere from H.G. Wells writing as early as the 1890s, all the way through Ernest Cline's Ready Player One, which just came out in the last decade. I think that this trend is especially apparent in Hollywood science fiction. What we tend to see is megacities are often treated, especially by white, Western, middle class, and usually male authors, as vertical dystopias, where industrial greed trumps political legislation, the gap between rich and poor widens every day, and both nature and humanity itself are made subordinate to technologies deployed in the name of corporate profit. And as we can see this here in these three movies, the first of these is Fritz Lang's Metropolis from 1929. The second is from Ridley Scott's Blade Runner from 1982. And that is supposed to be Neo-LA. And then the third picture is from Steven Spielberg's Ready Player One from 2018. And that is Columbus, Ohio. So as you can see, throughout this time, cities stay vertical. They stay completely denatured. And if anything, they get grimier and dumpier as time goes on. Now, given that the problems of megacity seem to be so overwhelming in so much mainstream science fiction, it's no surprise that such authors and directors really only have one or two ways to end their stories. You can do two things. The first thing you can do is try to distract us from the problems of the megapolis by following two characters who fall in love. And we see this in every single one of these movies. So we try to displace the social problems onto a personal romance that somehow will solve them. Or the next thing you can do, we can abandon the megacity altogether and relocate the scene of future utopia to smaller garden cities marked by a balance between nature and infrastructure, where technology is clearly subordinate to human needs. Of course, as early science fiction covers like the one you see here, the Amazing Stories cover, make clear, the science fictional garden city is really just what I've elsewhere called galactic suburbia. It is a future space where infrastructure is transformed by new sciences and technologies, and one where we seem to have managed to get the balance, that ideal sort of garden state. We have nature and technology in balance. However, one of the things we see here is that there's really no attempt to imagine the kinds of social and political change that we know attend these kinds of new sciences and technologies and new ways of living in the world. So in short, we get a future with jetpacks, but we also get galactic suburbia, the same white, patriarchal, capitalist, socialist relationships that you would have found in any good suburb in 1950s America. And you can really see it here. I think I love this image. It really is a beautiful garden city. And this is actually Buck Rogers with his jetpack here. This is one of the first representations of Buck Rogers outside comic strips. And I like, though, even as he zooms into the future, his wife, who is wearing futuristic shorts, I have to say, is down on the ground waving goodbye and probably getting ready to go make him a nice hot lunch. The other thing that's amazing to me is not just that these ideas about the future as being connected to galactic suburbia are part of science fiction, but that they very much came to inform much of our representations of science itself. And this is especially true in the way that NASA did photography for the first generations of astronauts in the 1960s. Here we have two pictures from the NASA archives. The first is Jerry Cobb, who was one of the first 13 women trained to be astronauts, part of the Mercury 13, but who never made it to space. And then second, we have, of course, Alan Shepard playing golf on the moon. What's amazing to me is not so much that we're celebrating how people are getting into the future, but we're celebrating very specific kinds of people. It doesn't matter that Jerry Cobb held all of the airspeed records in her class of airplane before she was recruited as the head of the Mercury 13. What mattered was that she could rock a Dior dress and a string of pearls like no one's business. And you'll notice that Cobb is always wearing her pearls no matter what she's doing for NASA. And then, of course, what could possibly be more galactic suburbia literalized than someone playing golf on the moon? It really is kind of the dream of 1950s suburban America. Under the flag, no less, of course. So let's move on to the next set of slides. And now we're going to start to tell a different set of stories about the megacity. And what I'm going to take you through is three phases of Afrofuturist storytelling that reimagine megacities from a variety of linked but still different perspectives. And I'll explain what that means as we go on. What we're going to see is that Black writers offer very different visions of the megacity. And I want to turn to two really early and important examples of this that are very much going to echo throughout the other stories that we talk about today. The first example is Pauline Hopkins' Of One Blood. This is a serialized novel from 1902, which follows the adventures of an African-American doctor who learns that he's the heir to a 7,000-year-old Ethiopian megacity called Telesar, hidden near the pyramids of Meroe, Egypt. The second story I want to talk about is journalist George Schuyler's Black Empire, which was serialized between 1936 and 1938 in the Pittsburgh Courier, which was the largest Black newspaper in the world at that time. Black Empire narrates the tale of an international group of Black geniuses who pool their talents and, when the white world will not accept them as equal, decide to destroy the United States and Europe and build a new Black empire in Africa. It's an exciting military romp, and it must have been utterly thrilling to have read it on the front pages of a newspaper at the time. What I find now particularly cool about Black Empire is that it features not just one, but two megacities. The first is an invisible megacity stretching from New York to the Deep South, when that Black people get around through high-speed transportation and underground tunnels. The second is a Pan-African megacity centered around what is currently Kakata, Liberia. Both Hopkins and Schuyler imagine megacities as rich sources of Black culture and techno-scientific innovation. These cities, as you can tell from the images I've put here, one is a drawing of Telesar, and the other is actually the current capital of Liberia, the current executive mansion, which bears a strange resemblance to the description in Black Empire. So I thought it was a really nice match there. And what you see in both these images is that we don't have either vertical dystopias or galactic suburbia. But what's especially apparent in the drawing is that what we get are garden megacities. So bringing together the garden city and the megacity that are characterized by horizontal lines and designs denoting the equality of all citizens within the Black Empire. Within these books, Hopkins and Schuyler describe their cities as effortless admixtures of African and especially Egyptian design and Western technoscience, which in both books we learn anything that white Western people invented, the African inventors got there first. And in fact, not only have Black super scientists from Telesar and Kakata already invented many of the things that we enjoy in the Western world, but in order to secure the dominance of their Black empires and their continued sustainability, they've developed hydroponics, solar energy, steel-infused glass, fax machines, and fiber optic communications, allowing them to create clean, efficient, and verdantly green cities. Of course, the super scientists of these Black empires understand that not all of the rest of the world may be ready yet for this level of Black genius. And so they've invented cloaking devices to hide their cities from jealous white people and created an elite female military squad to defend them. Now, if you're thinking this sounds like Wakanda 30 to 60 years before Wakanda existed, you are absolutely correct. And that's something we should think about and talk about later. Since the 1960s, the dream of the Black megacity has been realized to a certain extent through the rise of numerous Black majority cities, both great and small, throughout the United States. And yet, even as we begin to see the rise of Black cities, you see a discourse coming from, again, mostly white urban planners who bemoan the tragedy of cities ruined by white flight and who call for urban renewal based on slum clearance. And yet, if you go and look at images of cities from the 1960s and 70s, you see a much more complicated story. I would encourage all of you to go Google New York Photos 1970 Esquire magazine. It's a marvelous photo essay that will indeed show you crumbling infrastructure in decay, but also marvelous, vibrant images of all kinds of young people, Black people, women, people of color, LGBTQ plus people coming into the cities, creating new communities, creating new kinds of art, and even rebuilding infrastructure. The fact that there was such a disjunction between the sort of rhetoric of urban planning and the lived reality of cities at this time led visionary urban planner Jane Jacobs to argue that city dwellers, rather than urban planners, most of whom lived in the suburbs anyway, should determine their own destiny. This was an idea that was taken up by Samuel R. Delaney, who was the first Black and first out gay man in the science fiction community in the 1960s and 70s. Delaney was profoundly interested in Jacobs' ideas and used them as inspiration for the creation of his own heterotopian megacities in his fiction. So before we jump in and talk about those, you're probably wondering, what the heck is a heterotopia? Let me take a moment to tell you. So this is an idea that comes from the French thinker Michel Foucault. And as Foucault explains, right, utopia, we all know what utopia is. It's an impossible place we can barely imagine, organized around a homogenous set of people and a homogenous set of principles for living and governance that allow people to work together to create a truly good city for all of its citizens. By way of contrast, the heterotopia is an impossible space we can barely imagine that contains wildly diverse items, which reveal to us the limits of the homogenous frameworks we usually use to understand the world. So some of the examples Foucault gives are gardens, especially botanical gardens, that contain plants that could never naturally live together, libraries that contain books from diverse systems of knowledge, and for Delaney, megacities that bring together diverse peoples and practices, the challenging monovisions of this grid city. So Delaney makes heterotopia literal in Triton and Dahlgren. These are novels that feature megacities under siege. One of them is in a sort of utopian future, one's in a more dystopian future. But either way about it, the megacities are under siege and fighting for their lives. Clearly, these cities are dystopian for the white, middle-class, patriarchal people who cling to their edges. And in fact, in Triton, oh, I'm not going to tell you because it'll blow the plot. You should read Triton and find out there's only one way for a white middle-class man to deal with the heterotopia of Triton, but you have to read the book to find out what that is. I'm not going to tell you. So while these spaces are dystopian for the people who are considered the sort of traditional inhabitants and lords of the city, they become exciting, exhilarating, dangerous, but incredibly attractive spaces where young, queer, and even insane artists of all races, genders, and abilities come together using technology to craft new identities, new communities, and new modes of art. One of the key characteristics of Delaney's megacities, whether they're set in utopian or dystopian futures, is that they demand slums. Delaney celebrated slums and other kinds of outlaw spaces as necessary for the ongoing vitalization and creative expression and change of a city. For him, these kinds of zones become engines of creation, places of energy, ways to recharge and refuel the city. In Triton, he calls these unlicensed zones where the law no longer applies. And in Dahlgren, the entire city of Bologna, where the story takes place, is an unlicensed zone in the middle of the United States. Now, what's really interesting to me, and that may be interesting to some of you, is that Delaney was extrapolating not just from his reading of Jane Jacobs, but from his own experience with queer sexuality and city design in 1970s New York. This is something he talks about in great depth in Times Square Red, Times Square Blue, two sets of interlocked essays published in 1999. And the first talks about the exhilarating experience of being at the boundary between the law and the criminal worlds as a gay man in New York of the 60s and 70s. And the second essay talks about the plans for urban renewal and how they all but effectively destroyed the kinds of gay culture, sort of outlaw queer culture that Delaney himself really embraced. Okay, shall we move on then? We're almost there. Almost got you all to the future. Here we are, or to the present at least. So the last strain of Afrofuturism I want to talk with you about is one that's really cropped up in just the past two or three decades. And there's this new trend that I'm seeing in Afrofuturist storytelling across media, where we're talking about megacities as newtopia. And I will explain that term in a moment. But for now, I think one of the things that's really important and exciting that we've seen is that in the last couple decades, Black urban designers have been proposing new kinds of urban renewal inspired not just by best practices as already established within Western culture, but by the diverse knowledge systems that Black people themselves bring from around the world to the United States. So, for instance, in the last two or three years, we've had MacArthur Fellowships go to urban farmers Will Allen and Emmanuel Pratt, and they're doing really fascinating work, not simply on reclaiming land, but on finding ways to merge new developments in farming and urban farming with traditional farming practices brought from people all over the U.S. and all over the world. And it's pretty cool stuff. I recommend you check it out. Another great group doing a similar kind of work, but on the cultural front, is the Black Quantum Futurism Collective, which is an urban arts event collective that holds events around, I think mostly they're in New York and Philadelphia now, and they hope to become a model for other groups that want to do this. And what they're doing is collecting and sharing Black ways of knowing the world. So creating spaces, not just where they perform as artists, but where everyday people, the people who live in the city, are invited to come in and share their own experiences and have their own moment as artists and historians and as bearers of cultural change. So what we're seeing in Afrofuturist art across media is really an attempt to incorporate some of this exciting work that we're seeing in political Afrofuturism to think about what I call the literary newtopian future city. If a utopia is a space where everyone agrees on one set of rules, a homogenous space, and a heterotopia is a heterogeneous space where there are so many different ideas about what is identity, how do we live in the world, what is good practice, that no single vision can dominate. The newtopia tries to bring together elements of that to imagine not that we could ever reach a full utopia that we would all agree has the same rules, but the idea is to talk it out, to bring together in a heterotopian form all the ideas, all the practices we've ever had that we use to try to build better worlds for ourselves, and to pick and choose, to remix them in ways that make sense and are appropriate to the current cultural and historical context. In particular, what you'll see in the newtopian city is that you have a space where African, Afro-diasporic, and Western sciences are creatively remixed, where different ideas of the good city are explored and debated. I think that maybe one way we could think about this is if you're familiar with science fiction author Kim Stanley Robinson, he's one of the few people who really embraces utopian writing in the present. And he talks about the idea of the modern utopia not as a static object in time and place, but as a process and as a collective action by groups of people who want to work together to build better futures, even as they recognize no one's ever going to agree on what that better future is. Really quickly, there were so many authors and artists I could have talked about here, so I've picked the three that I absolutely think that you just need to check out if you haven't done so before. If you want to look at stories about megacities as utopia in print fiction, you check out Nello Hopkinson's, this was actually her first book, her breakout book, Brown Girl in the Ring from 1998. And when Hopkinson burst on the science fiction scene, she was celebrated by all the great science fiction luminaries as hacking science fiction by mixing together traditional kinds of science fiction like cyberpunk, those kind of dystopic near futures you'd see in Blade Runner and in Tron and in The Matrix, and swirling them together with Caribbean mythology. And in Brown Girl in the Ring, we have a future where poor Black people reclaim a dystopian Toronto, both from uncaring politicians who have fled to the suburbs and from the gang lords who are harvesting their organs for profit. And they managed to hold everyone off and build a newer, and as you can see from this cover, a greener Toronto through a combination of indigenous farming, medical, and religious practices that allow them to deal effectively with scientists, gang lords, politicians, and gods alike. That's a lot of work to build a new megacity, it occurs to me. And I think that even in its most fantastic way, it tells us the amount of work we're going to have to do, but it makes it possible. And that's exciting. Now, I think that the African megacity that most of us are going to be familiar with, of course, is Wakanda, and especially as it was reimagined in Ryan Coogler's 2018 film, Black Panther. Production designer Hannah Beachler essentially hacks the MCU just the way that Nalo Hopkinson hacked science fiction with her vision of the Wakandan Golden City, the capital, as a garden megacity built on the blending of Western and African technologies. And this is where I think this is a really great example of the Newtopia. On the one hand, there is a certain level of sameness to Wakanda. It draws largely on technologies and cultural practices out of Africa as much as it does out of the West, and maybe even more so. But there's never a preference for one over the other. We're presented time and time again with just a panoply of different kinds of technologies and ideas drawn from different specific African cultures. And my favorite example, though, of the way that Beachler blends together Western and African influences in her garden megacity is when we think about transportation in Wakanda. Wakanda does not have private cars, doesn't have suburbs either, I'd point out. It's a city surrounded by farms, surrounded by wilderness. We don't have suburbs, and we don't have cars, which immediately gets rid of a lot of the problems that we have with an oil economy and with an economy where not everyone can afford cars or use them and are then shunted off to other, often lesser kinds of public transportation. That doesn't happen in Wakanda. Everyone uses public transportation, and you use one of two modes. You're either using the maglev trains for high-speed transportation, usually for materials, and that's underground. And that's a very Western science fiction trope. We've been seeing maglevs for actually all the way back to the early stories I was telling you about. I think we have maglev trains, I'm fairly sure, in the Skylar story. So that's been a dream of science fiction for a long time. But what's more interesting is that if you go through and rewatch the city scenes in Black Panther, you'll see that most people are actually taking trotos. And the trotos in Wakanda, those are those sort of high-tech minibuses that we see going down the streets, moving just a little bit faster than people, but not too much so. And in fact, any street scene, you'll notice that people are out in the streets wandering around. They're sort of all around the trotos. And that's because you can walk around them without fear of getting run over. So it's very much a technology that's done to human scale. And in Ghana, which is where the trotos are from, these are privately owned minibuses that move along predetermined routes, but not at predetermined times. They go when enough people get on the bus and decide it's time to go. And so it was really important to Beachler to bring that kind of ethos, to bring those technologies and that ethos into Wakanda, because she wanted to create the Golden City as a city built on technology adapted to human needs, where we find an appropriate balance between technology and nature. And again, I would call your attention to the scenes with the Trotos. As you're watching them, take a look down at what's under people's feet. People are walking on hard packed dirt streets. There is no asphalt. There is no concrete in Wakanda. And I think that's pretty cool. You have dirt, you have plants, and you have light rail and minibuses. Finally, the last person I want to talk about is Nigerian-born, Brooklyn-based visual artist Olalekan Jeyefus, who I had the pleasure of meeting and being a co-guest of honor with at a conference last year. I'm really excited that I get to share his work with you now. I've always enjoyed it. So anyways, Jeyefus layers analog and digital images together in his work to create what he calls Frankenscapes, with histories and futures other than those preferred by white Western capitalism. And I've included two of Jeyefus's recent works here. These are two of my favorites. So the first one is called Shanty Megastructures, and this is from 2015. And this series of images, it's one from a series, was driven by the question, what if prime urban real estate was occupied by poor people rather than rich ones? What kinds of buildings would they build with the resources available? And once we've seen their hopes and fears blown up larger than life in mega shanties, what does that tell us about our need for different kinds of infrastructure, for different kinds of medical support, for different kinds of transportation, et cetera, in the city? And one of the things that Jeyefus really likes to do is to push back against the dream of bulldozing away the slums and all of the problems of the slums. Instead, he blows them up to the size of skyscrapers. And so you no longer can do anything but grapple with both the problems and some of the joys of these kinds of lives. The last image that I want to call your attention to all the way at the right is a piece that is on display at the MoMA right now called Frozen Zone, and it is part of a larger exhibit on Afrofuturism and architecture. The question here is, what if oil scarcity meant that we had to freeze our use of modern transportation? And if that freeze then freed Black biohackers to transform subways into movable community greenhouses, what would New York become? And so for Jayapas, this is very much his love letter to Brooklyn and what he hopes he could see Brooklyn become in the future. What I find fascinating is that it's hard for some people to see these images as an alternate history of the city or an alternate future. I first encountered Frozen Zone in an article written by, I checked on this, a young white male author who kept talking about it as a dystopian image and saying, oh no, Jayapas does all this work on the dystopian futures we'll have to live in if we don't have oil and don't have conventional modes of transportation. And I look at this picture and I see a Brooklyn overrun with greenery where people are lounging happily on the streets and other people are working on community gardening. And I don't see a dystopia. I see high-tech Eden, I think. And I think that that's why these stories are so important. Even when sometimes we're confronted with visual evidence of utopia, it's hard for us to see it because we've been so trained to only think about cities in certain ways. And this, to me, is the importance of looking at Afrofuturism, especially as it thinks about urban planning. Throughout their history, but especially today, Afrofuturist authors have reminded us that the things that seem apocalyptic to white Westerners, the condensation of diverse people into dense, small spaces, the collapse of what Euro-Western governments, white flight from cities, and the end of the oil economy might actually be the first step towards reclaiming Black ways of knowing the world and using them as templates in the present for building better futures in full color for all. And I also want to just really quickly in the end show you, this is my favorite of the Esquire pictures. And this is the Reapers, a New York gang, cleaning up an abandoned lot in Brooklyn in 1972. So much for the idea that white flight meant gangs were going to take over and destroy the city, so we had to raise the slums. No need, because the gangs actually went in and cleaned them, at least sometimes cleaned them up themselves. I just think that's cool.
Absolutely. Oh, it's super cool. Thank you so much, Lisa. There's so much to talk about, and yet I could almost just feel like saying, okay, game over, that's done. You said it all. I really love how you started. There was a time where the white male authors were writing when cities' populations were becoming majority African-American. Different people have different views of the same thing, and we are trained to kind of see these tropes in very particular ways. And, you know, the contrast with how then new voices begin to really pick this up, it's really clear in your discussion. And I'm immediately struck by the parallels in architecture and urbanism. Architecture and urbanism is a very male-dominated profession. It's certainly in this country has been majority white profession. And I know I'm thinking, and I'm sure a lot of the audience is also sort of wondering a little about the ramifications for designers. But before we kind of dive into more of that, you've amplified for us how sci-fi has taken on these themes of social and environmental justice, repairing existing places on Earth instead of reproduce suburbia.
Mars, right, yeah.
Tell us, how did you get interested in all this in the first place?
It's interesting because science fiction, like many institutions across America and across the West, has been majority white, too, at least in terms of the professional publishing community until very recently. Having said that, I do want to recognize people are always building other futures outside whatever we think is the main place of action. You know, this is what I'm interested in, the idea of co-futures. And originally, I thought science fiction was all about social justice and action. I grew up in a house with both my parents were science fiction readers, and they read a lot of new wave science fiction. And some of the first things I was reading were Samuel Delaney and Joanna Russ, a famous feminist science fiction author. So I grew up thinking science fiction always did this. And I was really surprised eventually to learn that it didn't. So I think from the beginning, I was primed to be interested in science fiction as a mode of social storytelling, just because that was what I was exposed to. But I came back to it. I actually spent 10 long years in the wilderness of postmodernist studies. And I came back to science fiction in the 1990s because I wanted a utopia for me. And I wanted to see stories about better futures and not worse futures. And there had been so much dystopian storytelling, both within science fiction and in mainstream culture. It was about that time that I came back to reading feminist science fiction, but then also really started reading a lot of Afrofuturist science fiction. I had actually met Nalo Hopkinson at a science fiction convention when she and I were both just starting out our careers. And it was utterly fascinating to talk to her about Jamaican perspectives on science and technology and to realize, or Caribbean ones rather, and realize there was a whole world out there. Then I found Sheree Thomas's marvelous anthology, Dark Matters. That's when the whole idea that there were indeed these other futures out there opened up. And I was like, this is it. This is what I'm doing.
Wow. Thank you. We're so glad that you did. It almost seems trivial to go back to galactic suburbia, given, I think, just the urgency and ambition of the Afrofuturist work that you've been showing. But given my own research on suburbia, I have to dig a little deeper. Yes, the stereotype of galactic suburbia is it's just repeating right. the exact same society. It's not changing right. society or societal roles. But in your right. book, you actually recovered some of the women authors' voices because they shifted the discussion. Tell us a little right. bit about, even if they were just baby steps, what kinds of things?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I think one thing is that what you see is that white authors, male and female alike, definitely prefer the suburbs to the city. And I just want to make that clear. I think Charlotte Perkins Gilman's Herland is a marvelous example of this. It's an early 1900s utopia. Go read it. You'll see what I mean. When women start writing stories about galactic suburbia, and women really get interested in telling stories about galactic suburbia after World War II. And I think that's no surprise because that's the moment in which the American government thanks women for their service during the wartime economy and then invites them to become domestic patriots by giving up their paid work to their husbands and going home to make their houses in the suburbs the first line of defense against communist ideology. So the idea was that women still had this important work to do in the suburbs. To a certain extent, women science fiction writers, they run with it. Absolutely. They say, great, if we're supposed to be women domestic patriots in the suburbs, let us do our jobs then. And so they'll tell stories about what that means. And more often than not, it turns out the way that women think about building the good future doesn't quite coincide with the way that necessarily the patriarchy around them is thinking. And so that's sort of the first moment when we see people start to use galactic suburbia as a way to critically assess the scientific and social relations in the present day. And I haven't done a lot of work on this, but my guess would be that with the diversification of the suburbs in the past two decades, that we're going to start to see galactic suburban stories by authors of color and by LGBTQ+ authors as well. Once again, sort of challenging the sort of normative ideas about what is the utopian suburb and what is the utopian future.
Suburbs are changing. I can definitely attest yes. to that. I want to just ask you, kind of before we bring Nitra in, you talked very articulately about some of the lessons for urbanists, that we should begin to start seeing apocalypse as potentially having a whole lot more opportunity than just end, that the end of oil could easily be something to really celebrate. What other thoughts do you have about the lessons that you hope city planners, architects, urban designers might really take from science fiction?
So definitely rethinking apocalypse is to be a major one. And this is certainly a lesson that can be learned from all sorts of people who have already experienced apocalypses in their world. I think, though, that other things that are important is to rethink our concept of what constitutes an appropriate science or technology. We have historically really privileged science and technology as a Western phenomenon. And yet, once you think about the techne, it opens up the possibility of seeing science and technology throughout time and space. Who's to say sometimes the things we've invented in the past are pretty good and may have relevance to the future? Sometimes we've made tragic, terrible mistakes, and we should learn from those as well.
Oh, absolutely. All right. I want to ask Nitra to kick us off with a few questions and comments that she has And then she will moderate Q&A. So, Nitra, what are you thinking about?
So many things. Since I'm moderating Q&A, I will limit my questions to just two. I know I can go on about these things forever. My first question, really maybe to both of you, is a grounding question, and it kind of builds upon Ellen's previous question about the responsibility of the privilege of being in a position in a higher academic institution as a white woman, gathering and disseminating stories of very specific storytellers who are able to have their voices heard. And then in terms of urban design and designers and architects and planners, as you mentioned, who sometimes live in the suburbs and are designing communities that they are not part of. And how do we responsibly use those positions of privilege to care for the communities that you are working with and telling the stories of, whose voices are not being heard? I know that we are talking about Afrofuturism, but part of the Black experience is being descended of stolen people on stolen land, and we currently sit on Muscovy land. And incorporating the working with the land and, you know, in indigenous practices without acknowledging where that comes from and that erasure. So it's, my question is, how do we balance all of those things in a respectful way?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, this is a question that comes up, right? I'm a white scholar who does work on Afrofuturism as one of her, you know, areas of interest. And I'm attracted to these futures and I want to share them with people. I mean, at some level, it's a very personal thing for me. Like, they feel right. I grew up in Detroit. I live in Atlanta. I lived in these sort of heterotopic spaces, and it just feels natural to me that these are the kind of futures we would want to live in. What I hope I can do, and what I like to think that I am doing, is using my position of privilege as a science fiction studies professor at Georgia Tech, which is pretty significant, to try to make spaces both to amplify these stories that I think are so important and that have been nourishing for me and that I think can be nourishing for lots of people, and to also make spaces for actually bringing in the artists and authors who are creating these. I think that that's something we can all do, though, as members of Georgia Tech, is use this amazing space we have, both virtual and physical, to share different visions of the future.
I really appreciate your question, Nitra, especially, I mean, I'll sort of focus on that question of designers and planners planning for a communities that they don't live in, they're not a part of, which is, quite frankly, how the consulting world works. That is most of who we're educating folks for. And yet, one is always very aware of the kind of double-edged sword, expertise, that it absolutely can blind itself to reality. Luckily, Jane Jacobs, who I was so glad that Lisa mentioned Jane Jacobs as somebody that Samuel Delaney admired. I just made my students read Jane Jacobs, her book on death and life in Great American Cities, cover to cover in 1 week, which is not easy. But by educating students with knowledge of all sorts of things that are happening in all the other places, you're also able to then bring that to a community while you're also absolutely going through the community engagement and community participation that we so learned was always a really important part of what she talked about. I think most of all of our urban design studios are in real communities, but the reality is we never get in school to really have the depth of community participation and input that I would really like to see. Is just the reality of schedules of classes and how much time we have. But I really think we do our best of at least trying to emphasize so that the students are learning that this is a really important step and you guys are going to have to do a lot more of this when you are actually out in the profession. It's both about the value of trying to help communities participate and do things on their own. But there is still, I think, a role for the professionals to actually bring some of that knowledge of what's worked in other places and to help enrich the conversation that people in a community can.
I think a lot of the, especially contemporary Afrofuturism I was talking about would agree. You don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You want to keep professional strategies and techniques. It's a matter of multiplying them, is seeing how can they match up with other strategies and techniques, either from other cultures, other professional practices, or from the ground up. Yeah.
My last question before I turn it over to the audience. When you were explaining some of the dystopia characteristics, I was like, oh, that sounds like now. We have this eviction moratorium and this booming houseless population. We're in the midst of climate change, and the city is going to raise a large part of the forest to increase a police state in a right. once majority Black city that some like to refer to as Wakanda, very incorrectly. So, and so I'm wondering, as we are living in what many would call the current collapse of this colonial project, how do we use our imaginations and science fiction planning and design to create a future in the midst of all of this chaos?
One thing I would say as a cultural historian is that we have to go back and look not just at the past of these literary ideas, but the cultural context for them. The things that you describe now about the current collapse of these projects is all true, but they're also literally the exact same things that were said about America in the 1960s and 70s. And yet, you know, as I've seen here, people like Sam Delaney were clearly able to imagine these other experiences. And I think the reality is we are able to imagine these experiences like Delaney does because we live them. We don't just live these dystopian narratives. We have to make choices as people that allow us to try to follow the Vulcan way of living longer and prospering. And it's the places we find in the interstices, in the gaps, and in the chinks of the world machine, as one of my colleagues likes to say. The practices we find when we're together in outlaw and forbidden spaces, the new people we meet, that's where that energy comes and the hope comes for survival, I think.
Danielle Wilkins, megacities are often aligned with techno-utopias. How are contemporary authors and artists challenging smart city systems and surveillances with proven racial biases?
That's a really great question. There's a couple authors who do explore this. Cory Doctorow, he is a science fiction author. He's been writing for a couple decades now, and he used to be the North American representative of the Electronic Freedom Foundation. And he, in a number of his science fiction novels, really takes on the issue of the surveillance state and often, in the guise of fiction, provides you with very practical day-to-day advice about how to skirt those kinds of systems. So I think that that's interesting. We do see authors really grappling with this and thinking about it. I think what you might want to check out is there's an awesome anthology called Multispecies Justice, and it's all about megacities and rethinking that coincidence of nature and infrastructure. And most of the authors are from non-Western nations, and they have some really interesting ideas about different approaches to things like surveillance systems. So I think that would be a great place to look.
It also makes me think of Ruha Benjamin's Race After Technology. It's nonfiction, but it is a really good examination of how technology promises progress when it actually right. exacerbates class and racial issues. So mm-hmm. I definitely mm-hmm. would share that as well. Great piece.
So that's probably one of the other questions Michael Chang had one. How do science fiction authors and Afrofuturists in particular treat the subject of gentrification? Is yeah. there a fictional approach that could inform our nonfiction reality?
It's a great question. And I'm sure that there are examples of people grappling with it. And I'm just trying to sort of think. Tresha Burke deals with this sometimes, doesn't she? In some of her short fiction, I think, maybe, in Let's Play White.
But I'm thinking generally the issue of displacement, which is yeah. constantly referenced, particularly in Afrofuturism. But yeah, specific pieces do not come to mind. I'll have to come back to
yeah.
that.
Yeah. So N.K. Jemisin's The City We Became, I think, deals with issues of gentrification. The conceit of the story is that once a city hits a certain size and energy level, it has the potential to become alive and sentient, or else it dies and sort of falls out of history. Her character is a young, poor, queer Black person who's been displaced from their home and is homeless and has to sort of help birth cities, learns that this is their destiny. And part of what the book will explore is like what happens with gentrification. And I don't know a ton more about it because I haven't read the full novel yet, but I think that might be a fruitful place to start to look at it. My guess is this might be a very new topic and we're just going to start seeing stories on it.
There's so many questions and we are running out of time. One that I want to kind of jump in on, the question Anonymous asked, I'd like to know if there are any sci-fi African writers. If yes, to what extent their representation of megacities are different from those of American Western writers?
The answer is yes, of course. Africa is a massive continent, and it's a continent that has seen unprecedented economic and technological development in a very, very short period of time. So there are a number of African authors, Nnedi Okorafor, who's actually both Nigerian and American, but spends time in both places. Deji Brice Olukitan is also a writer in a sort of similar position, but also African writers like Lauren Bukes, like Tade Thompson, and like Wanuri Kahiu, who's a Kenyan filmmaker, all of whom are absolutely imagining cities and megacities. And the one interesting difference that I see, not just in African science fiction, but also in Southeast Asian science fiction, is not just thinking about the coincidence of nature and technology, like nature in terms of plants, but thinking about the coincidence of technology, plant life, and animal life, along with human life. So really thinking about animals as citizens of the city and citizens of the future. And I think that that's really innovative and important. So what a great question. I'm glad we got a chance to talk about that.
And I want to jump on it with the best lectures I've seen was about 10 years ago by the UN chief demographer, Hanna Zlotnick, a red-haired Mexican woman in her 80s. And it was when the UN had first came out with saying that global population was at 7 billion and we would likely, by best possible target, we were going to be hitting 10 billion. And at this lecture, though, she was chastising National Geographic and a number of other journals and the media in general, who had immediately assumed they would put that headline and they'd show a picture of a megacity, Hong Kong or someplace. And she said, no, no, no. The majority of that next 3 billion on the planet will be cities in Africa of about 250,000 people. It's going to be very, really mid-sized cities is where at least 10 years ago, the prediction was where most of that growth would be. And I've personally just been really fascinated in trying to sort of figure out how do we prepare urban designers around the world to recognize that and that we still aren't really dealing with the fact that what happens when population stops growing? And that's really when the cities, and again, is it a narrative of a dystopia that suddenly our cities, our capitalist system is completely based on growth? Or does that become rethinking apocalypse's opportunity? I think we've got all sorts of really interesting things coming ahead to try to think about. Nitra, do you have one more favorite question to toss out from the list?
Yes. Well, to Megan McSorley asked, to what extent do you think that the worlds that sci-fi authors imagine ultimately come into being? Maglev trains, I believe, predated subway systems. Are there other examples?
Oh, there's an entire website devoted to this. It's called technology.com. So get it, technology and novels smushed together. It's a real web 1.0 site, be forewarned, but it is so information packed. It's really cool. It's just a community of scientists and science enthusiasts tracking down all of the first times we see things imagined in science fiction before they are invented in the real world. Now, and it's not that science fiction authors are prophets. They can't peer into the future and guess what's right. For those of you who ever, like, go back and watch Blade Runner and read Neuromancer, they live in a future without cell phones. It's the dumbest thing ever from our perspective, right? William Gibson once said he would be a rich man if he had figured that out. So yeah. Science fiction authors, they extrapolate from what's going on.
Oh, absolutely. I just want to thank you both so much. I want to thank the audience. You have been listening to episode 21 of Redesigning Cities, the Speedwell Foundation Talks at Georgia Tech. I am tremendously grateful to today's guests, Dr. Lisa Yazyk and Shanitra Wisdom. And even though we didn't get to answer my pet peeve question as to why are the doors on spaceships always hexagonal? Like, who decided that? Anyway, I think we've been absolutely inspired with such a range of much deeper questions to consider. So thank you for stretching our imaginations. Help us see the future, the present, and the past through new voices and with new eyes. So see everybody next time. Thank you.